It's Jane Clark, the historian at Aintree Racecourse, and you're listening to the Midweek Drive Morning Edition with Alex Levchuk.
Thank you very much. Okay, weather today, highs of 16 degrees centigrade, lows of 11 degrees centigrade. There'll be a northeast breeze, making it somewhat cooler than recently, but never mind. You know, if you want a northeast breeze, you call on Kayleigh Carr, a sort of northeast female breeze. Yay! So what's the weather like in Teesside, Kayleigh, after you've survived the excitement that is Freshers' Week in Teesside as well? Because you've been out, you know, now you're a serious third-year student reading journalism, checking out the whole system, etc., and you've already successfully managed to go down with Freshers' Flu, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It's actually quite sunny up here today, which is very nice, but I feel a bit chilly.
Kayleigh, it's always sunny in Middlesbrough. You should know that. It's it's a happy part of the world. No? Yeah? Listen, you must be wonderfully delighted, or life in the Carr household must have taken a whole new rosy edge now that Sunderland got a win against, Peterborough in midweek. 2-0. There we are.
Yes, I know. My sister actually went and she came back over the moon.
I thought that'd be the case. Never mind. Ed Wellman's turned up. He wasn't going to bother, but then I said, well, Kayleigh's on. Straight in here.
Yes. Did I hear you've got a Freshers' Flu there, Kayleigh?
Yeah, I do.
You sound very perky on it, my dear.
I sound what, sorry?
Very perky.
It's not being rude. You know, it's all right.
You sound lively and happy. Do you remember happy?
Because I'm talking to Alex and you lot.
Right. Well, you see, Katie, that's why we always say wonderful stuff. Katie, of course, you share that joy of going into your third year. So you see, there's Kayleigh up in the northeast in Teesside, you in Lincoln, etc. Who knows, you may end up on the same MA Community Radio course. But it's a different line. Any questions you want to put to Kayleigh Carr?
How is it in the northeast?
It's actually very good. Obviously, I attend Teesside Uni, which is really good as well. I'm really looking forward to going back into my third year. So that's something to look forward to after having such a long summer. So, yeah, it's all quite good, really.
I know, because I had 5 months off from uni.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was like as well. It's been a bit of a nightmare trying to fill me time and everything, but, you know.
Yeah.
it's a lifetime. You managed to fit in at least one trip down to Lincoln, you know, with the family. That's great. You know. Who knows? Maybe someday she'll introduce the parents to the whole system as opposed to sort of keeping them outside and denying all knowledge about sort of various tunes and such like stuff. Yeah, life continues. That's the important thing.
I will do one time.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, you've been sort of on the reverse of this. You've been in the studio at our sister station. You've connected all sorts of things. Do you know what Kayleigh's been doing? Which is really a must sort of attend, really, because just as Katie here has been blogging like a demon possessed, really, like a demon possessed by some sort of Black Sabbath Aston Villa supporting soul. Pity about Birmingham. Well, actually, no, Birmingham did very well. They won last night. They beat Swansea 3-0. Amazing. But do you know what Kayleigh's been doing, Ed?
Go on, Kayleigh. Tell us what you've been doing.
What have you been doing, Kayleigh, in terms of your online blogging kind of stuff?
Well, I've actually created a blog for Southside and Siren. It's called The Radio Booth, and basically it's me just talking about all my experiences at both radio stations.
That's right, I've read it. Well, I have now read it. Now you mention it, I have seen that
have
somewhere.
Have you?
Yes, I've seen it.
The Radio Booth.
Yep.
That's right.
And then basically I go on Southside Broadcast and Podcast site, and then I listen to other people's shows and basically just share my views and opinions on what I think, which presenters I like and maybe dislike a little. So, yeah.
I know. It's like a league table. Obviously, it's unofficially the sort of line with the whole thing. But, I mean, you know, Katie, you were doing stuff with Radio Warwickshire. So,
yes, Radio Warwickshire. Yeah,
you thought I was going to say Worcestershire,
didn't yes,
you?
Yes,
oh, no. Only kidding, you know, Warwickshire all the way. I mean, do you enjoy your blogging side of things? Because you actually got an award. Did you get an award, or was it the most...
I got one of my blog posts for Radio Warwickshire was in the top most viewed on the website.
The top most viewed on the website for Radio Warwickshire. And you'd be pleased to know, Kayleigh, because I know this sort of thing needs to go in, bearing in mind your fashion hair sense that is still there inevitably, that Katie is actually back to wearing sheep on her chest again, which is nice. Webcam today, but you know, she's got her sheep motif there.
Yeah, I had cats on my top yesterday as well.
It's like a menagerie. It's like a menagerie of fashionistas coming through.
I got one
through.
With a rabbit on as well.
Good heavens. Enough. You know, we haven't switched the webcam on this morning, but you know, who knows what could be happening from that point of view. Kayleigh, any questions you want to put to either Katie or indeed Ed about life, the universe, or indeed how to actually produce a top quality CV? Because technically, although we'll be throwing those last two questions at you, because the next thing is a pre-record, you were actually here with respect to True Dinietta. So you might say, no, it's not worth listening to. I tune out for about 10 minutes, basically. Or you might still think, well, that's quite nice. That's quite. I'm putting a CV together, you know,
yeah,
to see how
it's
things
very
go.
Very useful. So I'm sure I will listen to it again. So, yeah. I'll take down a lot more notes this time as well.
Yeah, very, very much to listen and take notes. It's wonderful. And of course, you can always go to southsidebroadcasting.podbean.com to access all sorts of other bits and pieces. If you're interested in last night's show, presumably, Katie, you were out partaking with all of the freshers in Teesside of various activities and the social life of Middlesbrough. And so you weren't able to actually tune in to the Midweek Drive on Wednesday between 5 and 7.
That's right.
It's all right. There is a satellite delay between Teesside and Lincolnshire. It's slightly longer than that between here and Florida, but it's still there. It's still connected. Well, the good news is it's already online, so you can actually go, Boris, at this very moment, you can multitask. You can go to our webpage, in fact, thanks to Jonathan, our ace webmaster, and sort of several months of nudging from my own sort of point of view. He has actually sort of updated the Midweek Drive page, and I've actually said you can actually go to that on sirenonline.co.uk. Click on shows, go to the Midweek Drive, and you'll find three sort of areas there. You can find heaps of photographs. I've already tagged both Ed and Katie this very morning, Kayleigh. I would have tagged yourself, but you just don't want to be my friend. It's okay.
I'll sort it out, Alex. Don't worry.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Eventually.
Exactly. So anyway, you can see photos, you can work through that. I mean, just looking back, we've done quite a lot over the last few months, haven't we?
Yeah. The last 5 months where Katie Grimerson's been lying with her feet up in a darkened room.
We
love it.
The Jive Pony, that was the thing that really...
Oh, gosh.
The CLA game fair. It was that moment in time with
I called to CLA.
Exactly. Yeah.
And you drove me back to Birmingham.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yes. We waited outside Katie Grimerson's house several moments.
I forgot to ask, did you get... back all right?
No, we didn't.
No.
We're still trying.
We are holograms. I'm in the passenger seat and Ed is actually driving.
But did you
driving.
Find your way back
no.
from my house to...
No. You didn't even know where you lived, Katie. You had to phone your mother to actually get those directions in.
The M6 is quite easy to find.
Yeah.
We were okay, yeah. I think.
See, Kayleigh, she gets her parents to bring her and then she leaves them, goes back, does the show, and then suddenly it's wonderful. It's great. I don't know, Kayleigh and Katie. There's a series there, Ed. I think we should to develop it. It probably will take the Paris and Nicola piece to a whole range of other bits and pieces. Yeah, Kayleigh and Katie. When Birmingham met Sunderland, genius. All right, last two questions for Kayleigh Carr, please. Katie Grimerson.
Kayleigh, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
I have, yes, indeed.
And can we look forward to connecting with you again?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, people often don't really know how to sell themselves well on a CV. This is the first impression you give to an organisation, so you really need to be able to talk about you and demonstrate your experience through it. People, really, there's a lot of support out there to get professionals to look at your CV, and that's the main thing we like people to know, that we're here to support them. So, you know, they're often too long or they often don't describe you very much and very often not really relevant to the job that you're applying to. So you need to target the CV to the job itself.
We're talking to editor of a local newspaper, Lincolnshire Echo, recently, and he was saying that the easiest way to actually end up on their reject pile if you're applying for a journalist's job is to have a spelling mistake in your CV. Makes perfect sense, but you do have to check them time and time again.
Yeah, this is one of the most common things that we come across as well. Spelling and grammar, always get somebody else to look over it. your CV and do the spell checks on. But it is, unfortunately, because it puts people off straight away.
Hmm. And also generic CVs. We hear a great deal about, well, it's one size fits all. It isn't, really. It depends on the kind of job you're applying for.
That's right. You really need to look to the requirements of each position and target it towards that. Often people just see a job and send that CV. And really, you need to be really looking at it. Give respect to the employer as well, you know, sort of really show them that, you know, you are right for that job. So you need to tailor it and really make sure you're bringing out your characteristics, your experience that are really relevant so they can see straight away that you could be a good candidate for the job.
Kayleigh, you're in the position of obviously putting into CVs. You're currently obviously just going into your third year of a journalism degree at the University of Teesside. Yep. Questions for yourself?
I basically just want to know how you would say you would set out your CV, because the way I've set mine out, some people say it's the right way and some people say it's the wrong, whether I've put things in the correct order and whatnot.
Trudy, what's the girl to do? Some people say you should do it this way, some people say that you do it that way. Is there a right answer?
Usually when you're leaving the university, you should put your education up near the top and then work experience underneath that. For other people who have maybe been out of education for 6 or 7 years, then you swap it first. The experience is proving that your education has paid off. So, but we've got a CV builder on the National Careers Service website, and you can go there, and we've got a helpline you can call sort of from 8 o'clock to 10 o'clock in the evening, 8 o'clock in the morning, 10 o'clock in the evening, 0800 100 900. And they can really support you. You can email your CVs to them and they can double check for you, and you can get professionals to look. Also check out your university as well. There'll be careers advisors there and they can sort of support you with help with it as well.
And that obviously applies to the home of Siren FM, Lincoln University as well, from that perspective. I mean, it's interesting in terms of phrases you need to avoid these days. Team player, works well in a team, results driven, self-motivated perhaps. Is it again, you need to make something go into your curriculum vitae which is unique to yourself? It's your own USP, really.
That's right. They can be very bland, really, sometimes. But if you can demonstrate that you've being a good team player by giving a little example or some sort of achievement that you've had in the past, you know, whether it's from work or volunteering or from university, being involved in students' union or something like this. If you can demonstrate it, then people start to really believe that you are putting this into practice rather than just using bland words.
65%. Put an incorrect length on their CV. Presumably that's because it's too long and people forget that actually you really only want to have maybe a couple of sides at most, preferably, you know, just two maximum before that's effectively it. You don't want to actually submit a dissertation or a thesis for your CV.
That's right. People, you know, are getting a lot of CVs through these days. Back in the 1990s, people used to have 5 and 8 page long CVs. Also for older workers, you know, just the last 10 to 15 years is sufficient to really be able to demonstrate the work that you've done and who you are. So I think often people make them too lengthy because they're trying to put everything on there, and you don't need to do that.
From your own perspective, I mean, clearly, as I say, you're now a key team leader with the National Career Service. You've developed sort of confidence-building skills, transferable skills, etc., worked with a whole range of folk in insurance and customer services. Is this something which kind of crosses across the bay? Is it something that's uniquely problematic to British job seekers, that actually we're not selling ourselves, and these are the tools that you need to ensure you take part in the interview game?
That's really true. I think we are very reserved. I run a lot of workshops on maybe whether it's CV writing or interview skills. And, you know, that's one of the major points that we sort of bring up and start talking through. What are your strengths? People are very shy about speaking about how good they are at certain things, you know. And this is one of the major things that I come across.
And we live in an international global economy. I mentioned, obviously, our colleagues in the States refer to this as a resume. Do the same things apply whether you're sort of seeking work in Britain, in the UK, or whether you're indeed sort of looking for work overseas and abroad?
I would check out, because when we come across people from other countries, straight away I can recognise whether it's Spanish and Italian, they have a certain way of making a CV, and then I sort of show them our way. So I would check out with each individual country that you're going to be applying to, sort of look at what their CVs are like, because you want to be, you know, sort of going with a format that they recognise. So if you are thinking about going abroad, then you know, I would look individually at that country and see sort of how they format their CVs. They're changing all the time, changing in our country, changing in theirs. In Europe, they often have photographs, so that in America, the same. But we're not quite there yet with the photographs.
Yes, I was wondering about that, because I've had CVs land on the desk at Southside Broadcasting, I'm sure Siren FM as well, which have had photos attached with that. And it's mixed feelings with respect to that. Sometimes you think, well, yes, it can personalise the whole thing a bit more. Another thing, you might sort of say, oh, I don't want to actually sort of, you know, identify that bit of myself. But then I suppose you've got the other sort of nine of things with of the online material. And don't get me started on social networking sites, because that's a whole other interview, Trudy, but that's a different perspective. Okay, a reminder, 0800 100 900 is the free phone call. Speak to a careers advisor, free 7 days a week, 8 a.m. to 10 p.m. Good heavens, you even work Sundays. I'm very impressed. There's that one. Or indeed you can go on the web to nationalcareerservice.direct.gov.uk. Is it ever too soon, Trudy, to actually start putting your CV together? Would you say, probably from about 16 or 17, that's where you should start thinking about it, and then really right up to probably your 60s and 70s? Perhaps.
That's right. I mean, we're here for people 13 plus, so yeah. We're here to give careers advice from people 13 plus, and it's, you know, I've certainly spoken to people who are almost 70, that sort of age, so it's not too soon to be thinking about it, you know, putting together a CV, whether it's a skills CV because you haven't got much work experience, but maybe, say, through schools and college, you might have been doing volunteer work or getting involved in writing magazines and things like this, so that it's not too soon to start thinking about it.
And we talked about some of the common CV mistakes. I did have a wry smile with the number one CV tip: make sure the email you're sending the application form from isn't a quirky personal email address such as liketoparty@gmail.com. Not good, really, is it? Yes.
That's right. I mean, I think it's good to set up a professional one, so you can keep that for your friends and then use the professional one for job hunting.
So you're saying that I shouldn't really sort of send in stuff to the BBC with @fluffytie.com, you know?
I wouldn't recommend that.
No, that's all right. Trudy, it's been fabulous just getting a general flavour of some of the opportunities that are actually out there and some of the advice and help that the National Career Service can provide. I've got two final questions for you. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us on Siren 107.3 FM and indeed Southside Broadcasting today?
It's been really great. Thank you very much.
So can we possibly prevail upon your good self to maybe join us again in the not-too-distant future and keep us updated, like a good CV, in terms of how the National Career Service are actually developing and growing?
It would be a pleasure to join you again.
Great.
Yes, thank you. Trudy Nieto there from the National Career Service. I was just about to make an announcement out, which I'm sure John Wenham, listening as he does keenly and critically to the programme, would have actually taken in the office saying, Ed, it's okay, you can return. The little black bag has actually been located and I had it here all the time. Apologies, Ed. I mean, I sent you off on a mission there. Honestly,
it was a very nice little walk for Thursday morning.
A little quick hello to John Wenham, our main sort of guru when it comes to putting sorts of the events diary together. It can't be bad, can it? Almost as wonderful as...
From international who's who to CNN, from film criticism to royalty, from South Africa to London, and now to the midweek drive on Siren FM, it's Richard Fitzwilliams.
Yes, absolutely. And Richard, you'll be pleased to know that we'll be joined probably next Wednesday on the midweek drive by the Queen of Spades. That's the Queen of Spades Creative Gardening, Katie Rushworth. Will hopefully be joining us after she created such a very positive impression when we were at the North of England Horticultural Society show recently. But here you are, Richard, clearly a man who actually appreciates CVs, resumes and such like stuff. What in your mind would be the perfect CV, Richard? Because I mean, it's something, you know, certainly undergraduates, but we all need to update it, keep the thing sorted out. You know, is it short and sweet? Is it a case of you want an epic? Is there an answer?
Well, the answer, I suppose, depends on the field. I mean, the perfect CV, oh, it's such a hard question, isn't it? Because it's in the eye of the beholder. You're submitting it to someone else. Therefore, it's how the CV will be received, isn't it, that's really the test. I mean, it is important, of course, and sometimes there's a very long one. If there's an epic, it can bore, but on the other hand, it can enthrall. If it's short and succinct, well, obviously that's too short for some. It varies. I think you bowled me a very difficult one.
I know, but you can handle these kind of things. I mean, much as Ben Ainslie could actually handle the New Zealanders, and it's nice to know that the Americans can actually win the America's Cup when their chief tactician is actually from the United Kingdom. That's just a thought there.
It helps.
Yeah, precisely. Okay, so another...
On the subject of winning.
Yes, James Hunt immediately springs to mind. Let's just quick... Katie, James Hunt.
No, I don't have a clue.
1970s, he was the glamour golden boy in every sense of the word. James Hunt, Ed?
I think he was my warm-up act, wasn't he? In terms of glamour in the 70s. No, never heard of him. I'm sorry, James
Unbelievable.
Hunt.
Unbelievable. You know, I mean, I won't even get started in terms of Ayrton Senna and other Formula One legends and so on. But, you know, what this clearly, Richard, is why these fine folk should actually check out the biopic about James Hunt at this very moment in time.
Yes, but you're absolutely right. And the fact that I have to say that I wouldn't have been able to come up with a synopsis, a summary of Hunt's success, if you'd asked me before I saw this movie. And it's an advantage. It really is, because obviously anyone interested in motor racing will go and see Rush. It's Ron Howard's film. It's about the rivalry between James Hunt and Niki Lauda. It begins in 1970, but it's mainly concentrating on the Formula One duel in 1976. The whole point is, however, this is a thrilling film. It's photographed by Anthony Dodd Mantle, who so memorably did Slumdog Millionaire so brilliantly, and it's directed by Ron Howard, Apollo 13, A Beautiful Mind, Fox, Nixon, need I say more?
Happy Days with the Fonz, you know, a child actor on Bonanza. What's not to appreciate about Ron Howard, really?
You're absolutely right. I mean, as a child actor, he's still quite a legend, apparently. And yet, here you've got a movie that is thrilling. So you get so involved in it. I have to say, it is a deeply moving testament to, admittedly, the vagaries who you might ask sane would race in the conditions they do and so on, but to the vagaries...
And indeed did, Richard, because in those days it was a lot more challenging and more risky than some of the sort of things that carry on today. It kind of pre the mustachioed Nigel Mansell and certainly post Jackie Stewart and Graham Hill, that was the era that James Hunt was very much to the fore and determined as a glamour boy. And of course the actor who portrays James Hunt is
Chris Hemsworth.
It's Thor. Thor, the Avenger, quite literally.
Yes,
the swordsman in Snow White and the Swordsman. Yes, Chris Hemsworth. So
and his lifestyle, good gracious me. I mean, there is the ideal bohemian...
It was demonstrating the kind of lifestyle of the midweek drive team, really, in many ways.
I understand.
Work hard, you know. I mean, Katie herself spent the summer at times getting up as early as 7:30 a.m. in the morning.
James Hunt couldn't have managed that, could he? I mean, his prowess in various areas is truly amazing.
I can see. Now, you're almost as speechless as Holly Cox was last night when she came back having seen Diana in the cinema. And I think Ed provided a 7 out of 10 for it. She seemed to be quite taken with Naomi Watts in terms of the whole essence, really.
Well, she had come straight back to the studio from watching it. And I would imagine it's probably, Richard, the kind of film that, you know, does make you feel a little emotional and upset.
The death, of course, of Diana 16 years ago, I have to say that obviously it was, as we all know, one of those moments that we never forget. And it's a brave film that firstly depicts this relatively recent for a biopic. I mean, let's be frank, it doesn't matter what happens if you make a biopic about a person who lived hundreds of years ago. It most emphatically does if their relatives are still living and if the death is relatively recent or even a certain number of decades ago. It still causes enormous controversy. And director Oliver Hirschbiegel knew perfectly well that when he made Diana, I mean, it was an explosive topic. The reviews have been absolutely scathing, and the reason for that is it's a movie that deals with the last 2 years of Diana's life, most particularly concentrating on her romance with the heart surgeon, Dr. Hasnat Khan, with whom she was deeply in love, her Mr. Wonderful, and she's played by Naomi Watts. Khan is played by Naveen Andrews. The problem in the film, if you encapsulate it in a single phrase, that is you don't care a great deal for the people.
But it was the Queen of Hearts meets the heart surgeon. Amazing. By
Very
the way,
good.
Are they coming to arrest you there, Richard? Is it a case of the police on the case once again? Please, it's all
Don't
worry.
Anyone? Oh, my goodness.
You see, they're online here as well. I'm going to pass this over to Ed, and he'll have to obviously deal with the contact. Ooh. It may well be folk wishing to actually sort of access all sorts of things. Probably Anne Frank, Chief Executive Officer of the Chartered Management Institute, who's going to be talking about a survey that reveals 9 million Brits tell at least one white lie a day at work. Seamless.
The problem with Diana, I have to just mention,
yes,
is as opposed to the brilliance and the way you're swept up in Rush, it's the script.
Wow.
And also, it's whether or not it's tasteful to make such a film. But even if you, and I believe it isn't, but if you ignore the last point and you just concentrate on what you're seeing, it's very much like a Mills and Boone romance. Now, you're dealing with Naomi Watts, who's an excellent actress. Good gracious me, The Painted Veil, a movie where she played an unfaithful wife. And as penalty, she's taken into a disease-ridden part of China.
And King Kong. Let us not forget King Kong.
Or The Impossibles.
Or The Impossibles.
Yes,
exactly.
Let's not forget. But let us also remember that taking on this role, this, talking about an icon, now obviously, for example, whether it was cavorting on the Johnny Carl with Jodie Fyatt, who hardly says a word, in this movie Diana does it to make Hasnat Khan jealous, or whether it's her campaigns, for example, most particularly in Angola against landmines. There are certain scenes in this movie where we've seen them before, and obviously they're staged very much as they took
Clearly,
place.
The fact, Richard, we've spoken about Diana for three consecutive sessions here suggests that there's something about this whole process. Katie, is this the movie that you'd actually say, yeah, I'm off to go and see that?
I'm not really a fan of biopics.
Not a fan of biopics?
I've only just watched The Iron Lady and I was so disappointed with it.
Why were you disappointed?
Because I felt like there was too much going on in it, kind of thing. Like, I was confused as well. Like, she was starting
so
off
was
in present
Thatcher
day and then it
Street.
Went back to, like, the past and then I was like, I can't be arsed to watch this.
Oh, dear me. I'm
just still watching Skyfall.
But, you know, one of the problems, I mean, now thinking of The Iron Lady, it was made while Lady Thatcher was alive and caused an enormous amount of controversy, as predicted. The right thought that, firstly, it was appalling to show her with dementia, and secondly, that it was biased against her. The left felt that it showed her as a conviction politician and gave her too much stature. If you look at it politically, it was so divisive as she was personally, but, of course, Meryl Streep triumphed in the main role at the Oscars, something again that was predictable, although Viola Davis, as I remember, ran her rather close.
But fine actor though she is, I can't quite see Meryl Streep signing up to portray Diana, Princess of Hearts.
Too sensible, because Naomi Watts really was taking on... It's a role which, I mean, it's not that she's bad, because there are scenes where she has an uncanny likeness to Diana, but the problem is she's been working at it so hard to get the gestures right, to get the mannerisms right, and there's something bogus about this film. The problem is, you mentioned hearts. Does the film have a heart? How involved are we in the characters? In what, as we, no spoiler, because as we know, they broke up, and when that scene occurs, frankly, it left me completely cold. Now, if you're talking about someone as iconic as Diana, and that is the result, then this film is a dud, and that is precisely what it is. The reviews were scathing because the script was Mills and Boone, and you have an actress like Geraldine James as Una Toffolo, the friend of Diana's and confidant, and frankly, her wig's all askew.
Good heavens.
Well, if your wig's all askew, a challenge that frequently impacts on certain shows within the Siren era, who knows what could actually be the case. Let us meet. Last night, Richard, we were talking to an author based in Brazil, but over in Britain, whose name was Keith Melton, has produced a history of the Captain Cobbler's Revolt, when in the era of Henry VIII, there was a little revolution taking place, a mini-revolt, certainly, not revolution, a revolt in Lincolnshire against, obviously, the Crown at the time. Slightly earlier than that. Oh, was it? No, actually, slightly later. We obviously had Richard III, or Richard III.
Now, that is absolutely fascinating. Mm,
Bosworth Field, and where's he going to be buried?
Yes, now, on that topic, I think that we're going to have quite a lot of interesting debate. There is a judicial review which is looking into this. I think that it's very likely that Richard III, since he was discovered in a car park in Leicester and has lain there for 500 years...
I mean, surely the charges alone would be extortionate. And you just think, what was he doing there? What were his... whose PR agency thought that was a good idea? Richard, lie low. Give it 500 years.
There you have it. First, the University of Leicester is involved in discovering him, which they do brilliantly, and judicially, apparently, the excavation involved a clause which said that Leicester Cathedral and think tourism, think megabucks, because he's notorious internationally and nationally for being the probable. I hedge my bets on this one, because I believe he probably did murder the two princes in the Tower simply because he had both opportunity and means declared them illegitimate. It was a famous case. We've all heard of it. And this was in 1483. He inters them in the Tower, and they're never subsequently seen after the summer of that year. But again, obviously, this is a royal burial. It's got to be done with a certain amount of decency. There's a great deal of controversy, as we all know, about who actually murdered the princes. So what is the case for York? Well, firstly, he grew up in Yorkshire, and secondly, he spent a great deal of time there. He was popular there. He was
comfortable. Did he perchance, Richard, have a fondness for ferrets, flat caps and stotty cakes? Because for me, any one of those could actually be the ultimate sine qua non, which would identify him as needing to be in Yorkshire.
That is something which you must speculate on, and I think continue to speculate on. Whilst I mentioned the clinching piece of what for me is evidence. I mean, since he's not with us for obvious reasons, he can't choose where he was to be buried. He never did, as far as I know. There are rumours that he had set up a college for clerics at York Minster. That it was never actually begun, but he'd planned to, so was it for his burial and so forth. We don't know, but what we do know, this is incontrovertible. Bosworth, where he was hacked to bits, the battle where Henry Tudor defeated Richard's army, the Stanley family, changing sides so pivotally. After that, his body was mutilated, stripped, displayed in public, and finally buried in Greyfriars Church. And all of this was in Leicestershire. It's not a happy memory for Richard. He was, and did fight gallantly at Bosworth against the odds, and tried in a desperate cavalry charge to hack down Henry Tudor. He got quite close. But having said that, I mean, obviously, when you've been, as it were, mutilated and displayed in that way, I think that, frankly, the place that he was popular, if you're not going, and certainly no chance of Westminster Abbey, because the memorial above the little princes, Edward V and his brother Richard, states that they were murdered by perfidious Richard. So you're not going anywhere near the Abbey, and the royal family doesn't want anything to do with it. Probably Richard.
I feel as though it's history repeating itself once again, really. It's, I mean, you need to move. We'll get to France before too long. Katie.
As in Alan Bennett's The History Boy, yeah. History is one damn thing
after another. Exactly. Katie, any questions for Richard?
No.
Ed?
I'm going to go and see Diana this week, Richard. There we go.
Good heavens.
I am going to.
You're going to see Diana ahead of Lawrence of Arabia?
I'm afraid so, yes.
And the spinal cap tap.
There's always, you know, the case of Diana, there's always the supreme appeal of any material that involves her. I'm not just referring to a certain newspaper, which still so frequently has either her or matters dealing
Look,
with health.
Richard Desmond obviously likes Diana. There's a whole range of things. That's why constantly...
Well, I like a great deal of what Diana achieved, but one thing that isn't not an achievement, and that is for the director of Downfall to make a movie that, quite frankly, is as lackluster as this. It's not just Naomi Watts herself, though, as I say, I don't think that she overall carries it off, but she tries most valiantly. But consider this, Florian Henkel von Dommersmark makes The Lives of Others, which is genius, and The Tourist, which bombs. Wolfgang Petersen makes Das Boot, which is absolutely fantastic, and then subsequently makes Troy, which is ghastly. So Oliver Hirschbiegel, another German director, makes a superb Downfall about the last days of Hitler, and look what he comes up with now. Definitely
Everything is open to interpretation. Richard, we're going to have to throw those last two questions at you. So, Ed, will you do the business, please?
Absolutely delighted to. Richard, have you had a reasonably interesting time on the phone with us this morning?
Indeed. We travelled from motor racing in the 1970s to one of the greatest royal icons ever, a royal who is extremely notorious. But where will he be buried indeed? We shall find out when the review reports.
And to help us do that, can you join us again, please, maybe on the first Thursday in October?
Yes, most certainly, because then we must be looking at Cate Blanchett's new movie, directed by Woody Allen. But remember, it's getting an outstanding achievement award at the Golden Globes this year. Will he turn up for it, or will he... stay away, we don't know. Blue Jasmine, and also a movie about General MacArthur and the Emperor.
And like General MacArthur when he actually left the sands of Iwo Jima.
I shall return.
With lashings of country news, science fiction views, top interviews and a clear audio muse, it's the Midweek Drive on Siren 107.3 FM.
Clearly, the C word is something which still resonates with concern, stress and all manner of routines, and the treatment that's often referred to as aggressive treatment in all sorts of ways, chemotherapy and so on, can also have knock-on effects as well. We're delighted to spread some good news now, though, with respect to treatment of cancer, and breast cancer in particular, by inviting the consultant medical oncologist for the NCC Freeman Hospital, Dr. Mark Verrill, to actually join us. Good morning, Dr. Verrill. And this good news basically means that hopefully patients who are suffering from a particularly aggressive form of breast cancer will actually have an alternative and slightly less invasive form of treatment.
Yes, that's right. We've been using a drug called Herceptin for roughly one in six patients with breast cancer for more than a decade now. Until now, Herceptin's been given by an intravenous infusion. What that means is that each time the patient's treated, we have to get access to a vein to deliver the drug, so some sort of plastic tube has to go into the vein. The drug's then given through a drip over about half an hour, and then everything has to be disconnected and flushed, and the patient's then only then able to leave the hospital. The new form of Herceptin is given by a subcutaneous injection, which is an injection just underneath the skin. It's given into the thigh, and so it's the same kind of technology that's been used for injections like insulin. So it's very much quicker, given over a few minutes. It's very much simpler for the patient, and therefore it cuts down the amount of time they need to spend in hospital.
And also, though one is loath to actually talk about accountants and cost effectiveness within the NHS, it is actually good news for the budgets of the NHS, because it actually means that there could well be an advantage financially to the NHS from savings about this.
That's right. There will be less cost to deliver the drug. So the cost of the drug itself is about the same as the intravenous form. The calculation is slightly different because subcutaneous is a single dose and intravenous is dosed to the size of the patient. But we will save a lot on delivery costs, but also, and I think this is really important, on time, and therefore we'll actually be able to treat more patients in a day. We may be able to move treatment out of the hospital setting to community settings or to the patient's home, and that will free up resource for treating other types of cancer with the many other new drugs that are coming through at the moment. So there's a win all round from this new technology.
And presumably it's good news from the psychological aspects of treatment on this particular basis, if they don't have the stress factor of obviously having to go to a strange place, have all the strange treatments. If it is possible to obviously treat at home, that presumably can be good news.
It will be. We can't eliminate the hospital visits completely because chemotherapy still has to be given in that setting. And we always give chemotherapy as a prelude to Herceptin, if you like. But we know from a study done looking at patient preference that patients overwhelmingly prefer the subcutaneous form of the drug to the intravenous form. And the reason that most patients preferred the subcutaneous drug was the amount of time that they spent. And it's clearly allowing women with breast cancer to live a more normal life and not have these long visits to the hospital every 3 weeks to receive their treatment.
Understandably, folk get very upset and stressed when they're dealing with all of these areas and issues and so on. It's important to notice that the Herceptin drug itself has actually not only gone through the European Medicines Agency, but it's also gone through all the necessary tests, etc. It has actually been rubber stamped. It is actually perfectly safe. It does its job without, hopefully, too many side effects.
Yes, we've been using Herceptin for well over a decade now for women with secondary breast cancer. We've been using it to try and prevent recurrence of initial breast cancer since 2006. So this is a very tried and tested drug itself. And the new formulation has been tested in a randomized way and has been shown to be at least as effective as intravenous Herceptin. And to date, there have been absolutely no concerns about the safety of the new way of delivering the drug. So it looks good, and we're hoping that over the next few weeks we'll actually be able to switch all of the patients that we're treating in Newcastle from the intravenous to the subcutaneous form of the drug. So there will be, I would imagine, immediate benefits for those patients.
Herceptin, obviously the brand name. I think it's also referred to as trastuzumab, which sounds like
trastuzumab.
Exactly. There we are. So it takes me back to my days of organic chemistry. You get some bizarre names coming out of this area. It's phenomenal.
Wow.
Dr. Verrill, in your time, I mean, obviously you're head of Department of Medical Oncology, deputy lead clinician for breast cancer in the North of England Cancer Network. Been there over the last decade or so. Is it sort of too soon to actually say, well, actually things are getting better when it comes to what was once deemed to be completely incurable? Think we can actually look at maybe some slight light at the end of the tunnel? I mean, we hear a great deal about obviously cancer research and oncology routines. Do you see an improvement? Or is that too broad a line, really?
No, I don't think so. Looking at breast cancer, which is my main specialty, if we go back to the late 90s, we didn't have drugs like Herceptin. Herceptin came along then, and it completely changed treatment for that group of people. So we know that using Herceptin and drugs like Herceptin, we are seeing significant advances in the treatment of secondary breast cancer. Women with secondary breast cancer are living for much longer. We are controlling the disease much better. This year already, we've seen the launch of a new drug called pertuzumab, which is a sort of partner drug to Herceptin and improves the effectiveness of Herceptin. And the knock-on then, as we move these drugs into primary breast cancer, so newly diagnosed breast cancer, is that more women are actually being cured, and we see the cure rate go up year on year. And if you look at the national statistics, we see, despite increasing numbers of women being diagnosed with breast cancer, we see fewer women dying from breast cancer each year. So we are curing more and more women, and we're seeing similar advances across the spectrum in cancer. I think breast cancer is a great example of what can be done over decades, but in the last few years we've seen new drugs in melanoma, we've seen new drugs in colorectal cancer, we've seen drugs across the board that are literally changing the natural history of this very horrible disease.
Hmm. Well, it's been fascinating just getting a little snapshot. I mean, obviously, lots of interesting concepts there to work through. I mean, broadly speaking, to get down to the nitty-gritty, it is a case of the Herceptin jab. From today, it's actually been given the green light by regulators and, indeed, NHS England. We have two final questions for your good self. Dr. Mark Verrill, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us here on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition for Siren FM today?
It's been great.
It's our customer satisfaction, you see, Dr. Verrill. We kind of have to do this on a regular basis. We have to fill in scores and so on. Only kidding. But the next sort of scenario is, can we perhaps look forward to maybe connecting up with you again in the not-too-distant future?
I would hope so, and hopefully there'll be another major advance that we can talk about.
Well, I do know that some of our listeners in our sister station at the James Cook University Hospital, Southside Broadcasting, will very much appreciate that, and I think excellent work all round. Dr. Mark Verrill, many thanks indeed.
Thank you.
There we are, you see, and I felt that as he's a major oncologist up at Newcastle, a Freeman Hospital, is a nice way of actually leading into our next ace, Tyneside Soul, who won't be quite celebrating as much as his colleague and friend Ian Lennox would celebrate over Newcastle United's fantastic victory before they go head-to-head against Manchester City in the next round of the Carling Cup. But, you know, he is a goodie, isn't he? Who are we speaking about, Ed?
Arthur McKenzie,
hey,
sir.
Arthur McKenzie. I believe, Arthur, you know the Freeman Hospital.
I know the Freeman very well. It's a first-class hospital, and if it wasn't for the Freeman Hospital, I wouldn't be alive.
Well, that's why I thought you wouldn't mind giving up a couple of minutes to
Dr.
Mark.
Absolutely fascinating what he was saying, and I'll tell you what, you walk in there and you put yourself in their hands, and you know what the thing is about the hospital? They make you feel as if you're the only patient in the place, and it's absolutely terrific.
We are, you see, it's positive stuff. I'm sure decent hospitals exist in the East Midlands and Lincolnshire as well. It's just we don't know.
Of course they do.
Yeah, exactly. It's very true. It's the NHS. Just quickly getting that point across there. Very, we can't have everybody flowing up to the northeast, Arthur, after all. Katie Grimason's back in the studio. She's back in the house. She's back in Lincolnshire. The flags of celebration have been just fluttering in the breeze in every sense of the word. Katie, have you got any questions you want to put to Arthur McKenzie about writing? Because obviously you're fretting about your dissertation. And who knows, Arthur, as a wordsmith par excellence, might just have some motivatory thoughts in terms of how you get on with it.
Yeah. What's been your favourite thing to write?
Everything I do is my favourite thing to write. I know that sounds ridiculous. Even if I write a letter, I try to write it from the heart. I actually write letters. I very rarely type letters out. I always write them because there's some sort of connection between me and the pen and the paper. And funny enough, talking about dissertation, I don't know how you're doing it, whether you're doing it on a laptop or whatever. But sometimes it's better to write a thing down on the paper so you actually see it and you actually feel it. And you actually see where the stress lines are as you're writing, because sometimes if you write fast, it means your brain's working fast and you can hardly read it. If it's nice and plummy, if I call it plummy, it means perhaps you're taking too much time on it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And in terms of obviously that, when you transfer it to a keyboard and a keyboard skill, how do you tell there if it's got growing pains and birthmarks?
The only time you can do it is if you print it off and have a look at it. And as everybody knows, it's lovely. It's formatted beautiful. It looks fantastic. Mm-hmm. You print it off, you start reading it, it's absolute rubbish.
And I'm glad you said rubbish, because obviously there's a pile of something else that could spring to mind. But not in your own case. I mean, let's face it, Arthur, you're a bit like Mozart. You first draft, oof, it's there, it's sorted. Or maybe
not really.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the other thing that people often forget when they are writing things, that sometimes it is a developmental work in progress. You're always changing. It's never going to be absolutely 100% sorted out, and you need to make that decision in terms of when you do submit it and so on. But, you know, it's a craft, isn't it, Arthur?
Well, it is, and I think sometimes, you know, when you've got it on your machine, you look at it, and as I said earlier, it looks nice, it has a nice look about it, it's tidy, it's formatted, but you're frightened to change anything in case you spoil the look of it.
Yeah.
Well, it's not about the look of it, it's what the content is, it's far more important.
There we are. Does that help, Ed?
No, I absolutely agree, and that writing things down. Actually, I've been writing something quite long recently, and it's the first time I've actually picked up a pen and used it extensively, I think, in years. And I suddenly realised that I'd forgotten how to write, and my handwriting had got very messy, so I've been enjoying devising...
People were referring to him as Dr. Wellman, and just on the basis of his writing alone. They were asking for prescriptions. It was amazing.
Yes.
But it is a skill, isn't it, that I think possibly we're losing as a result of tablets and laptops and so forth.
I totally agree. Mm. And I always take my time to write a letter. And, you know, it's a personal thing, isn't it? Whereas if it's typed and it's just got a PP signature or whatever it is at the bottom, you more or less just discard it. I think that if you get a handwritten letter from somebody, you know they've spent a bit of time on it and they care.
I always write my lecture notes rather than use a tablet or a laptop. I prefer to write them.
And it's less distracting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, even now, I'm trying not to be, but I've just had a look at Facebook and Twitter, and it's just there in front of me. I mean, Arthur, you're far more interesting, but there's a lot of distractions in life, aren't there?
Do you tweet, Mr. McKenzie?
Oh, sure, no, see.
No,
what?
No way.
Yeah, exactly.
Not interested. If you've got time to do that, you've got time to do something more important.
Oh, there we are, you see.
Go and get the tea.
Fish,
that's
fish,
what I need to do.
If you've got time to tweet, you've got time to do something more important. Yeah, exactly. Better things to do, other fish to fry, other canaries to actually... Never mind.
That's
exactly. And, of course, it wasn't a canary, it was a budgie. Let's get these facts right. You see, that's how an urban myth can evolve, from the budgie that made the ultimate sacrifice by almost attempting to do a phoenix-like arising from the ashes. It now becomes a canary. I don't know.
Of the RSPB,
and we can't have that, Arthur, in any way at all, really. So, Katie, anything else you'd like to sort of put to Arthur? I know because you'd be pleased to know we will be taking a short musical break shortly. It'll be a reprise of Gord Bamford, his selection from last night, of course, When Your Lips Are So Close. Would you like to actually listen to Gord Bamford, Arthur, and When Your Lips Are So Close?
Oh, I suppose so, yes.